Well, good morning. Aloha nui to yui. Isn't this a beautiful setting for the Feast of Tabernacles? Boy, you're right. You can't see any. Is there anybody even out there? You're here. Good. This is an absolutely beautiful setting for the Feast of Tabernacles. You've got palm trees, beautiful trees, thick trees. There's even willows on the island. You've got chickens. The chickens are going to be a recurring theme, I think, at this feast. They become a real issue, apparently. I was talking to Tony, who's the manager, and he said, it's become a problem because they're beginning to attend class here at the college. And the first day, how many of you think this is Anthropology 101 here at the college? We had 40 people yesterday show up, and they thought they were sitting in on a class. But they liked it, so welcome. Mr. Lum, who is a native here of the Hawaiian Islands, he was telling me about this podium. Watch. It's moving down. Now it's moving up. Is that cool? I could do this for the next 20 to 30 minutes. No, we've got some work to do. We've got some work. Now, thank you very much, by the way, for the choir and the accompaniment. I must tell you, I was rather taken by one of the very pretty flute players, the one with the dress. That was my wife. Thank you very much. Always thank the choir and the accompaniment for their service to the church. I grew up in Southern California in the 1950s and 60s. If you're trying to do the math, and it seems age is a big issue at this feast, I'm 25 in dog's years. And in those early years, we had a home in Southern California, in the Pasadena area. And we loved the San Gabriel Mountains, my family did. And at about 7,000 to 8,000 feet, there's an area called Big Bear. And my parents bought some land. And so every few weeks, up we would go to the mountains. We went up this curvy road, and my sister and I would always say, Mom, we're going to throw up. So we spent most of the trip going up the mountain with a bucket around our head. We never did throw up, but it was great, great theater. But when we were there, my folks bought a very large Army surplus tent. It was Army green, and it was waterproof. It was large enough. It was only four of us. It was large enough, I think, for the 51st Infantry and the 101st Airborne and a few of their planes. This thing was enormous. But it was kind of rickety. It took forever to put up and take down. But we camped, and we camped, and we camped, and it was a lot of fun. Later, the tent gave way to a small cabin, and that, too, was great fun. As the years passed, my parents both died, and we inherited, and we still have this small cabin. But I still remember that big old tent fondly, and many, many memories. But it was temporary. And if you have no idea where I'm going with this, you're at the wrong feast. Today, as we sit here in this beautiful, beautiful building, and by the way, Tony is the manager. He's the gentleman with the office over there. Tell him how beautiful his facility is. Tell him how pleased we are to be here. Try not to lose anything. He's already apparently picked up 12 bags of Legos from just the first day. And also just a real quick bit to Mr. Jim Tuck. Jim, as the coordinator, I've worked with Jim before, and it's a pleasure he and his wife to work with. But many times Jim hears some things when something goes wrong. Anytime something goes wrong, great or small, the Tucks will hear about it. So I know you will. I want to encourage you to do so. Tell them how much you appreciate being here and him coordinating it with his wife. And so as we sit here in Kauai, and you do know where I'm going, I'd like to discuss with you today tabernacles. Surprise, surprise. But three in particular. The past, the future, and then the present tabernacle. We will look at it in its various forms. We will look at its ever-increasing and ever-present biblical set of concepts where tabernacles relate to each and every one of us sitting here. Now, right now, it relates to our past and it relates to our future. Because we have an audience, it's a mixed multitude. We have young, not so young, new in the faith, old in the faith. We're going to attempt to talk to all of you because we all are affected by this. It'd be a little bit technical. It'd be a little bit of Greek and Hebrew. I apologize for that, but it's very, very important to understand these days. So let's step back in time, quite a bit of time, about 2,400 years worth to the desert. You are an Israelite. I want you to picture yourself as an Israelite. I mean, you're already celebrating the Feast of Tabernacles, the Feast of Booths. So you're an Israelite, 2,400 years ago. You've left the bondage of Egypt, and you are now in the desert. And where should we begin? There are many places, but one of the best is in Leviticus chapter 23. So if you turn there with me, please. I've always noticed in the years, and by the way, Mr. Tuck and a few others, this is my 40th year in the church. So I guess, what does that mean? Does that mean I've stopped wandering or I'm still wandering? But it's been a long time, but I've seen my own Bible, and we've all had many Bibles. But when you open up a Church of God Bible, Leviticus 23, if you had it for any length of time, it's pretty well marked up. I wouldn't ask you to do this, but you can go to one of the older members if they still have their Bible of 10 or 15, 20 years ago and take a good look at Leviticus 23. It's well-worn. Probably got notes in it. Probably different colors. I saw one Bible years and years ago. There must have been 8 or 9 different colors. That's how important this chapter is to us. It's very important. And so we pick up the theme, obviously, in verse 33. It says, the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel, saying, the 15th day of this month shall be the Feast of Tabernacles for 7 days to the Eternal. We just celebrated that first day. It says, on the first day there shall be a holy convocation. We had that. You shall do no customary work on it. We didn't, except for the many people who served. For 7 days you shall offer an offering made by fire to the Eternal. We had an offering yesterday. Some of those people that took that money out of their wallet, there was fire when they came out of that wallet. So we made an offering to the Eternal. It is a sacred assembly, and you shall do no customary work on it. And then there's an interlude of 2 verses. We pick it up again in 39. Now, in some of your Bibles, it's a very interesting phenomenon or a very interesting fact. I'm reading from the New King James, which is pretty much the standard text we use. But you will see a shift in terms. It's all the same word as we'll see. But you'll first see the tabernacle of booths, but I want you to hear how the word changes. Also, verse 39, on the 15th day of the 7th month, there's a repeat. After you've gathered in the fruit of the land, you shall keep the feast of the Eternal for 7 days. On the first day there shall be a Sabbath rest, and on the 8th day a Sabbath rest. And you shall take for yourselves on the first day the fruit of the beautiful trees, branches of palm trees, the boughs of leafy trees, and willows of the brook. And you shall rejoice before the Eternal, your God, for 7 days. You shall keep it as a feast to the Eternal for 7 days in the year. It shall be a statute forever in your generations. You shall celebrate it in the 7th month. You shall dwell in booths for 7 days, that your generation may know that I made the children of Israel dwell in booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt. I am the Eternal, your God. So Moses declared this to the children of Israel, the feast of the Eternal. This is the Feast of Tabernacles. It is also the Feast of Booths. Now, the word booths and the word tabernacles are the same word. It is the word in the Hebrew, Sukkot. Phonetically, it's S-U-K-K-O-T. It's not Sukkoth. It's not Sukkoth. It's Sukkot. That is the plural. The singular is Sukkah. Sukkah is the word in the Hebrew. Now, I spent about 10 years in New Jersey and New York. How many of you have ever lived on the East Coast? I know Mr. Dowd has. Well, quite a few of you. We cover the New Jersey, New York area, and it is fascinating. Do you know that there's a lot of Jewish people? Did you know that they now have, I kid you not, you can look it up, you can Google it. They have Sukkah Depot, where you can, I'm serious, you can buy a sukkah. In fact, I just happen to have the site here. Are you ready? Our special deals.
Such a deal.
Sukkah assembly for $24.99. The new premier easy sukkah. The paneled sukkah. The elaborate sukkah. Because it's that important to them. I'm not making fun of it. I'm telling you, this is an incredibly important time of year for the Jewish people, for Judaism. But they're all about the structure. They take great care. In fact, I can remember when we lived back there, just before we'd go to the Feast of Tabernacles, there would be people that would be picking out very specifically palm fronds, the fruit. It is extremely, extremely important to them. There are four main elements: the palm, the willow, the fruit of some of these trees, thick trees, the palm. If any feast site is indicative of this of booths, it is Hawaii. I know there are others, but there's palm trees everywhere. We had one. It was a true story. We were out last night enjoying the sunset. In the evening, and a palm frond. We were on the balcony, and a palm frond fell from one of the trees, and I said, this would be a great prop. The bad part was it was about 20 feet long and it wouldn't have fit in the car. So this is indeed, we are surrounded by the emblems of tabernacles. The study of tabernacles is a growing field of study in academia and theology by those who do not keep it. There is a growing amount of papers and books that are being published by different groups and organizations and academies and theological seminaries, because it is growing. The realization that these days that you observe are becoming more and more well known, all the more reason we should be well versed in it. As I quote a couple of authors, you note that they do not observe this as a religious festival. Cardinal Jean Danilou, in his landmark book, The Bible and the Liturgy, says this about this time. The events of the Exodus became the figures of eschatological end-time realities. Here is the origin of the typologies, the representations, as interpretation of the Feast of Tabernacles. The prophets later speak to the life of the just and righteous man in the Messianic kingdom, dwelling in tents or tabernacles, symbolized by the tents of the Israelites that dwelt in the desert. They see deeper significance. It's starting to dawn on them because it's so evident. It really is. But God has given us a very specific glimpse. As we heard in the first message, you have been given an advanced preview of what these important days mean. This temporary dwelling theme is in a staggering number of places in the Bible. Typologically, the biblical types is ever present. The word palm, the word shelter, the word dwelling, the word booth, all relate to the Feast of Tabernacles. Its ultimate objective is the dwelling of God with man. In fact, the Bible is in many ways a book of different dwellings, but focused on two specific entities, God and man, and their tabernacles, their tents. And so you have left Israel. Excuse me, you've left Egypt on your way to Israel, to the promised land, but it is not near. So where do we live on this journey? We know that to travel to Israel or Canaan was approximately a week to a month, depending on how you figure it in the route taken. We also know, unfortunately, that you will be taking a small detour of 40 years. But in all those years, the tents that were used, possibly to begin with were palm fronds and willows, carried with them, gave way to animal skins. We really aren't told very much about the consistent architecture or the composition. But there was another tent where we are told a tremendous amount of information, a very special tent that existed in the wilderness and the wanderings. It was very different. And God would dwell there from time to time. Turn with me, if you would, to the book of Exodus, chapter 40. I could read you chapter after chapter after chapter about this specific tabernacle. And it was probably unbelievably beautiful to behold. But I want to give you the essence of this tabernacle where God lived in chapter 40, the end of the book of Exodus, beginning in verse 34. Now, I want you to please hear the words that are used, the words that are repeated. Anytime you read biblical verses where the words are repeated over and over and over again, that is a very common Hebraic style of writing. Emphasis, emphasis, emphasis. Listen to the words as they're repeated. Verse 34, then the cloud covered the tabernacle of meeting, and the glory of the Eternal filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter the tabernacle of meeting because the cloud rested above it. And the glory of the Eternal filled the tabernacle. Whenever the cloud was taken up from the tabernacle, the children of Israel would go onward in all their journeys. But if the cloud was not taken up, then they did not journey till the day it was taken up. For the cloud of the Eternal was above the tabernacle by day. The fire was over it by night in the sight of all the house of Israel throughout all their journeys. God was there with them. The cloud, over and over again, picture it, covers the tabernacle, spreads over the tabernacle, and is the tabernacle of God. What is interesting about this word tabernacle in these verses, it is not the word sukkah. It is a completely different word, Hebrew word of miskan or miskan, which means simply dwelling place. It is the dwelling place of God, different than sukkah. This tent was so very, very important to the people of God. When the cloud moved, they moved, and everything had to be moved. What's interesting about this Hebrew word, when it is translated back into the Greek in the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, when that Hebrew word is used, it's transliterated into a Greek word called skene, or skeno, and that will be very important for the rest of what we have to talk about, so please remember that. So it means dwelling place or a tent, but it is not a sukkah. The relationship that God had with man at that time was very different. God's desire from Genesis to Revelation is to dwell with his people. That is his goal. And as we'll see, he has used many forms and many phases of attempting to dwell with his people. God would descend in a cloud. Man would prepare to meet him. We know from the Day of Atonement that we just celebrated that special preparation had to be made before they could go into. And not every day, only one day a year. The people had to prepare, the high priest especially had to prepare, and the tabernacle. All had to be cleansed before God could be there and meet with them that one day. Very special day. As we said, occasionally the cloud and the fire would move. Israel would move. All the tents, the children, all the food stocks, all the animals, everything would have to pack up and move. Can you imagine it? It must have been a massive undertaking. If you've ever seen, and not to use a too carnal an analogy, a circus. How many of you have been to the circus? The tents are enormous. How many of you have been to a conference or a convention where they use these enormous tents, some of them half the size of this building? It takes days to put them up and days to take them down. And they're not anywhere near as careful as they were when they moved God's tabernacle. When it was disassembled, it had to be moved very, very carefully. The ark, the bronze laver, the altars, the veils, the wood, everything had to be packed up and moved. Later, as they settled in Israel, there was a semi-permanent tabernacle or temple was built. And we know of the temples of Solomon and the temples of Herod. We know that both of them were destroyed. That's why they were semi-permanent. Where was God and his desire to be with man? In fact, there is a Jewish tradition that just before the Herodian temple in the first century was destroyed, the Jewish sages say that God's spirit left the temple. It was not there. The prophets, Isaiah and Zechariah, Haggai, nearly all mention God's desire to dwell in tabernacles, in dwelling places with God. God has not given up. In fact, there's a whole series of Psalms. 118 culminates it. We will not turn there. And those are the songs of ascent. Those are the psalms that were sung during the days of tabernacles, written so long ago. So God was not deterred. He implements his second phase. In the first century, with Herod's temple soon to be destroyed, God descends again. Turn with me, if you would, to the book of John, the Gospel of John, and the first chapter. Now, we may read over this over and over again, and it is so incredibly important in what it says. There's so many, what we say, typologies here. Symbols, emblems, concepts. John uses the Greek language very effectively. In fact, when you learn New Testament Greek, they give you one book and one book only to learn first. It's the book of John. Because the words are spoken very clearly, stated very clearly, but they have great, great meaning behind them. So let's read them. But we're going to focus on one verse in particular. In the beginning was the eternal, and was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him nothing was made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. This man came for a witness, to bear witness of the light, that all through him might believe. He was not that light, but was sent to bear witness of that light. That was the true light, which gives light to every man coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him. The world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own received him not. But as many as did receive him, to them he gave the right to become the children of God. To those who believe in his name, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. We call that by many names. It's the incarnation. It's when God, or Jesus Christ, comes to earth. It's interesting, the words that are used, the Word, the Logos. But there is a verse, it is 14, that captures my attention and ours too, and many of you have studied this, I'm sure. Verse 14. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory. The word dwelt there is our old friend, originally from the Hebrew, now in the Greek, skinu. It means dwelling place. It says that God dwelt with man. It is one of the most fascinating sections in the entire Bible. It's where God descends again and dwells. He tabernacles with man. No longer would God dwell in a simple tent or a tabernacle itself or even a beautiful temple, but God picked another tent and dwelling place. But the terminology is so descriptive. This one concept is associated, the skine, is associated as it is in the Hebrew with God's dwelling. This was God. Tabernacle, a temporary dwelling, but it is limited to God. This verse in particular, tells us that God dwells now in human form. It is a mystery. It has been debated for millennia. Was he God-man or was he the man-God? Was he a deified man or was he the embodiment of God on earth? He was walking and talking, flesh and blood, just exactly as you and I are, but perfect, therefore much, much more than a man. He was the Word. We believe that he was the explicit example of God and his word, his law. He was that Logos. In fact, he was the fulfillment, the prime fulfillment of the prophecy that Moses gave. There shall arise a prophet like unto me, him you shall listen to. He was the lawgiver's lawgiver. And this is the Jesus Christ that we worship. Philippians 2 says he took on the form, the morphos of a common lowly servant. And I believe we know very little in truth about what happened. It is a mystery to be revealed, I think, on the other side of the resurrection. There is also an interesting, purely speculative aspect of this all. Possibly, just possibly, Christ was born during the Feast of Tabernacles. We know that he was circumcised the eighth day. So it's a very good fit. No. What's also interesting is that over the last 30 to 40 years, another church organization has sought to adopt the Feast of Tabernacles with their feast day. The articles are ever increasing, and that church is the Roman Catholic Church. They wish to identify the Feast of Tabernacles with their feast day, the Feast of Christmas. The first such interpretation goes back to the 300s of Gregory of Nyssa. He connected, as did many others, Christmas to the Day of Tabernacles. He says, the subject of today's feast, December 25th, is the true Feast of Tabernacles. The human tabernacle was built up by him who put on human nature. Danilou, who we quoted earlier, says, it is precisely the Feast of the Epiphany, the Appearance, on the 25th of December or January 6th, which is the Eastern Orthodox Church, which commemorates this manifestation. Fascinating. What it means is it's all there. The incarnation with the Feast of Tabernacles. They just have it in the wrong time, the wrong season. We know when the Feast of Tabernacles is. It's in the fall. What is odd, as many have pointed out, if Christ was indeed born during the Feast of Tabernacles, when was he conceived? Obviously 9 months earlier, which would be December and January. Was Christmas designed, as many people feel, to mask this feast, to keep it hidden in its proper time? Again, it is pure speculation. But I couldn't have asked for a better hymn to be sung today, because we already believe this, I think, to some degree. Turn, if you would, you don't hear this very often, turn to a hymn that we sang today, and this is in my notes. Please turn, if you would, to Psalm 185. Now, it's known as the Battle Hymn of the Republic. We have it titled, Mine Eyes Have Seen the Glory. In Hymn 185, stanza 3, it starts out, and I will not read, and I surely will not sing it to you. In the beauty of the autumn, Christ was born across the sea, with the glory in his bosom that transfigures you and me. It mentions two aspects of the Feast of Tabernacles. It's in the autumn and the transfiguration. These are more themes that are ever present for this week. This week is a very, very important week. So we sang about it. So we've talked about the past. Let's now move on to the future, because there is a future. We will use the Apostle John again in his use of the word tabernacling and the verb skenu as it relates to God's dwelling. John uses this word and its cognates 4 more times. Once in the book that we just read, but the other 4 times occur all in one book. All of them in one book. John wrote that book as well, and he uses the word again. It's the book of Revelation. We will not look at all 4 verses. We're only going to look at 2 for this discussion. If you'll turn all the way back to Revelation chapter 7 for me. What I don't want to do is talk too much about the book of Revelation as it relates to the 8th day and the end of this festival, but I want to give the continuity of this day and the themes that start way back in Genesis and the law and all the way into the book of Revelation. Let's begin in verse 13 of Revelation. Then one of the elders, this is a dialogue between John and one of the elders, answered, saying to me, who are these arrayed in white robes, and where did they come from? And I said to him, sir, you know. And he said to me, these are the ones who came out of the great tribulation and washed their robes, made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore they are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple. And he who sits in the throne will dwell among them. And John uses the word skenu. He sits on the throne, will tabernacle, will dwell among them. They shall neither hunger any more nor thirst any more. The sun shall not strike them, nor any heat. You'll notice there is this imagery again of the dwelling, of the tabernacle, of heat. Where is their heat? Where is their sun? It is the desert in the wilderness during the original Feast of Tabernacles. For the Lamb, verse 17, who is in the midst of the throne will shepherd them and lead them to living fountains of waters, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. The dialogue that John has with this elder is beautiful imagery. The New International Version says that God will spread his tabernacle over his people. Like a shepherd, he will take care of his people. He will dwell with his people. His tabernacle will be their tabernacle. Move, if you would, to Revelation chapter 21. We're just going to take just a couple of verses here. This is the new heaven and new earth. In verse 3, it says, "And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. God himself will be with them and be their God. And God will wipe away every tear from their eye. There shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying." Notice that the words again. He uses the word tabernacle, dwelling with God, with man. You'll notice the similarities in the use of the word tears. There is peace when God is with man. This is God's total objective. This was his point, to ultimately bring God and man together. The Feast of Tabernacles symbolizes this continuous theme of God's desire to be with man. I can't understand why. The reverse is surely not felt. Man surely does not want to be with God, doesn't believe in God, doesn't honor God, doesn't obey God, doesn't believe in God's law, wants nothing to do with God. So many times we can see that God uses various typologies, various examples of God's great desire to tabernacle with man. But there is one more. We have covered the past. We have covered this beautiful future that God has in store with us. And now we move to now, the present. We have the past. We have the future. And I know in reverse order, we're going to now talk about the present. This concept is found in many places of man tabernacling, dwelling, being with God. If you'll turn with me to 2 Corinthians chapter 2, I had a choice, as all speakers do, to pick from a number of sources. But every time I did this, there were so many that I wanted to reference, but I thought this sums it up the best. It's 2 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 5. And we will end here. Paul writes to the church at Corinth, and Corinth was a very interesting city. I've been to ancient Corinth. Becky and I were very blessed with the opportunity. It's not a very big place. There's the city of Corinth in Greece, and then there's ancient Corinth. And it is a fascinating place. So I don't know that we walked exactly where Paul walked, but it's a fascinating, fascinating place. It was a very cosmopolitan area of the world. I read one commentary. I don't know if this was a derogatory remark or not. I'm a little sensitive to Southern California, but it said it was the Southern California of the known world, full of every vice and corruption. I said, the dude is obviously not from L.A. But it was this crossroads. It was a major metropolis at the time. And so when you read Corinthians, as one commentator said, it's almost like second Californians. I was offended at that too. But notice who he's talking to. He's talking to a very cosmopolitan group of people, very diverse group of people. He says, "For we know, verse 1, that if our earthly house, this tent, is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens." Listen to the imagery he uses. The word, obviously, the word tent there is the word skenos that we've heard so often. He uses the word building. He uses the word house, but a house not made with hands. The tent he's talking about, well, let's keep reading. He says in verse 2, "For in this tent we groan earnestly, desiring to be clothed with our habitation, which is from heaven. If indeed, having been clothed, we shall not be found naked. For we who are in this tent, this tabernacle, this dwelling place, we groan." He repeats it. "We groan, being burdened, not because we want to be unclothed, but further clothed, that mortality may be swallowed up by life. Now he who has prepared for us this very thing is God, who has also given us the Spirit as a guarantee, a down payment, an earnest. That's why we have God's Spirit. So we are always confident, knowing that we were at home in the body, this current tent and tabernacle. We are absent from the eternal, for we walk by faith, not by sight. We are confident, yes, well pleased, rather, to be absent from the body and to be present with the Lord. I think that's everyone's desire, to ultimately be with God. That's what this feast is about. It is wonderful to be with one another. Very important. We were in Maui last year. My wife, we were commenting. We said, it's a whole different group, by and large, of people. I mean, the Tucks are here, and that's always good to see familiar faces. But many of you, we didn't see last year. You were elsewhere, also celebrating the Feast of Tabernacles. So this is a very unique group. This group will never be assembled again together. Not ever. This is so unique. And so Paul gives us this beautiful imagery, this wonderful imagery of exactly where we are currently. This earthly house, this tent that we are in, will one day be destroyed. And there is something that Jesus Christ will bring with him at the resurrection. He will clothe us with something different that he brings with him from heaven. We groan in this tent. We are burdened. Paul would know all about tents. Why? Well, it tells us in the book of Acts, he was a tent maker. Who would be more suited? He's perfect for the job. If you wanted to learn about tents, you go to Paul. He knows all about them. Our tents, our bodies, are all we have. Many tents among us are weathered. They're tired. They're weary sometimes with well-doing. In Eagle Rock, we left many people home. They were ill. Their tents, they're wearing out. They're just tired. Your tent, it may be like my tent. Now, you can't see all of you, but I can. But my tent's got some tears in it. Stitched them up. My pole. I'm not as upright as I used to be. I hunch over a little bit. I've got some tent pegs missing. My windows are a bit clouded. So we patch these things up. That's what we do with this physical tent. In a lot of ways, I'm like that old army tent I talked about. There's a fondness for it. But I want you to see what I see. There are so many different tents that I see. No two of you are alike. There are younger tents and older tents. Some that everything's there. All the parts are there. They're new. Everything fits. It's like you just bought it. When I buy a new tent, it's wonderful. Trying to get it back on that stupid box is sometimes... who builds that stuff? But no two tents are alike. You're not all the same age. That would be weird. You're not all the same age. You all don't live in the same area. You don't all live in the same house. You don't all drive the same cars. You surely don't wear the same clothes. Very few of us that have on. Think of that. There's 300-400 people here. Now, there may be maybe a few Hawaiian shirts. The guys are a little stunted for this feast. You know, we wind up going to the same five places for Hawaiian shirts. But no two of us are alike. There's different colors of tents, different shapes, different sizes. Some of them have gone through different storms, weathered different battles. They've had things happen to them. That's why they get patched. And sometimes they get repatched. And sometimes repatched again. Sometimes one tent pokes at another tent. We shouldn't be doing that. Leave other people's tents alone. Some of us aren't held up real safely. We might tip over. Some of us have been, are, and will be weathering storms. We need all the flaps in place. We need our tent pegs grounded, and we can use the analogies. You get the point. You understand. What's different is that all of our tents may be different. All of our tents will have gone through different seasons, but all of our tents contain the same thing. the same spirit. Because we see only the outside of the tent. And all your tents, by the way, they look beautiful. You look so colorful here. But that's all we ever see. We rarely see what's inside the tent. And that's what God wants. As Paul tells us here, he does not want the outside tent. That tent, like that old army tent, will one day completely disintegrate. It will be shed and a new tent will be given. It's what dwells in the tent that's so important. What dwells in the tent allows us to act differently, or we should. Be different, or we should. Say things differently, or we should. Because we've been given a spirit that makes it so. We sometimes put tents over tents, make them look better, and that's okay. Paul says, though, elsewhere, in fact, one chapter earlier, he says that we are like earthen vessels, clay pots, like a tent. It could have cracks on them and super glue parts of them and bond to another spots. Earthen vessels, but we contain a treasure. So again, be careful with other folks' tents, because we all contain a very special treasure, a gift that God has given us. And so we have examined three different phases, times of God's dwelling place, past, the future, and back to the present where we are today. And that's what this week pictures. Historically, you are celebrating an event that has its history of 3,500 years ago. Passover is the same. Passover and Tabernacles, by the way, Passover and Tabernacles have the same type of theme. We end where we begin with this very ancient festival. But it has a future and it has the present. So I would ask you that you remember all of this that we see here. All of these tents, the condos or the hotel, motel, wherever you may be, this building. All of it, this podium that seems to move up and down and left to right and wherever else it does. It's all temporary. Won't be around. It's not meant to last forever. None of it. And again, we at this feast will never exist again like this. So enjoy it. Rejoice and take advantage of it. And in fact, this should never exist again. I think one of the beauties of the feast is they are singular events. Some of you have celebrated 40, 50, 60 feasts. No two are alike. The people are different. The places are different. The messages are different. And we're different. And that's the way it should be. So when we look at someone else's temporary dwelling, be kind. Be gentle. It's what's inside the tent that's important. We will all receive, those that obey and follow God's calling, a new tent. A new reality in the future. I would also ask you to bring the feast home. Many people did not get to go to the feast for a number of reasons important to them. So bring the feast back to those who could not come. Remind them that we celebrate, all of us, whether we're here or elsewhere, we celebrate a feast where it began with physical men in physical tents meeting a spiritual God in his dwelling. It moved to a God dwelling in human form through Jesus Christ, tabernacling with man. Still in physical form, but it shows God's desire that ultimately spiritual mankind will be dwelling with his God and Jesus Christ forever. So it is a progression that leads to the greatest of the relationships that man can have and can achieve. And therefore, we are a blessed people. May all of you enjoy this festival of tabernacles, the one you live in, the one you will yet have. Happy feast.